Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Keval Ramani, and today I have with me Aditya Ramanathan, and we're going to be freestyling about the world that we're living in today and what it foretells for the world that we're going to live in the future. This sort of dates back to a study that we'd done about a year or so ago, looking at possible scenarios to the new world order. It's an interesting paper that's available on our website, and we'll also share it in the show notes here. We thought of three different axes in terms of the shift of political power, economic power, and the role of technological disruptions. We didn't consider health as a serious disruption at that point in time, but currently, as we see, this is the biggest disruption of our times at the moment. So we thought of, based on these three axes, what kind of world orders could emerge, how could different actors be playing geopolitics, and what would be the implications for India. And we'll talk a little bit about how, despite us not having necessarily considered health in that context, given the breadth of the document, we can still see certain parallels in terms of what is happening in the world and what's likely to emerge in the future. So Aditya, I'm going to start with you firstly. Let's just look at the world that we are currently living in, right? I mean, it's such a change from 2 weeks ago. Borders are shutting, countries are talking about building indigenous capacity, and there's lots of blame game and sort of geopolitical wrangling going on. So tell us a little bit about what's happening in the world right now.
Yeah, it's amazing, Manoj. You know, a month back, we were all worried about the coronavirus. But a lot of our focus was on, you know, the regular stuff that was going on. What are India and China doing in the Indian Ocean region and stuff like that? And all of that has taken a definitive backseat, I think, in terms of media attention. What we're seeing now is really a situation where the Chinese claim that they have the situation under control, whereas you're seeing death tolls rise elsewhere. The WHO has declared Europe to be the epicenter of this pandemic. And we are fearing an explosion in India right now, though we can only hope that doesn't happen. And this also comes at a time when the US and China have been going through a very difficult time. You've just had a trade war, and you've had escalating rhetoric about a whole bunch of other issues relating to the Indo-Pacific and security and so on. And what we're seeing now is both Chinese propaganda trying to deflect attention from what happened within China and the origins of this epidemic in China. And on the other hand, you have American officials determined to blame China and also using very unhelpful terms like Chinese virus as Donald Trump is. So it's not a very happy situation, obviously, as I'm sure our listeners are aware, locked away in their homes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the tricky thing, right? You know, I mean, you would always think of being, that would be the dream, right? You know, in the summer vacations, you're sitting at home and you're doing nothing. And today, suddenly, it feels like such a chore. It's very, very difficult. But let's look at this, right? There's also sort of, at one level, there is this blame game that's playing out between the Chinese and the Americans. At another level, there is also sort of actions by both sides and signals by both sides with regard to other countries, which suggests that they're also looking beyond what is the immediate. So the immediate issue is obviously dealing with sort of this public health crisis that the world is facing. And once we are done with that, as in when that is done with, there will be a case of the impact of what's happening right now and what the steps have been taken right now to deal with this crisis, what impact that will have for the shape of the world going forward in terms of how we trade with each other, what it does to the relationship between traditional allies, and what sort of new equations are sort of coming into place. I'll give you an example, right? Just last week, we had this Indo-Pacific call initiated by the Americans, and that had, apart from the four sort of quad countries, the US, India, Australia, and Japan, you had New Zealand also on the call, and you had a couple of other countries on the call. And the idea there is that, you know, if you can get countries within this Indo-Pacific region, so, you know, South Korea, Vietnam, if you can get these guys on board and you can share experiences, the choice of this as a mechanism for a call, as the Indo-Pacific as a call, given the sort of geopolitical connotations of the phrase Indo-Pacific and the idea of the Indo-Pacific strategy, is again a sort of geopolitical signal, right? Yeah. It's not about we need to be working together. If you need to be working together, you're also working with the Chinese, given that they have dealt with this for the longest than the rest of us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, after 9/11, it became conventional wisdom that rivalry between states was a thing of the past, and what really mattered was these transnational threats. But as we see both in the American response to terrorism and in the response to this current pandemic, when these transnational threats occur, the way states respond to them actually correspond to the geopolitical realities of the time.
Yeah, and it's fascinating how, so this isn't the American response, right? Trump announced a shutdown with travel between the US and Europe without even consulting his European partners. And while that's fine, everybody has done these things, and even the European Union itself wants to shut itself down because of fears of not spreading the disease. The fact that there was no coordination is a problem. And the fact that Trump's generally tended to be unilateral in the way he takes his decisions is a problem. While he's done all that, they've still sort of initiated this Indo-Pacific conversation. In contrast, you look at the Chinese, and they've done everything bilaterally. There's very little multilateral. There's been some attempts. The Chinese ambassador to India initiated a call with South Asian and Eurasian countries to share experiences and talk about COVID-19, containing the spread.
Yeah.
But there's been very little that they've done multilaterally through institutions. They've essentially done things bilaterally or through foundations like that Alibaba and Jack Ma Foundation and things like that, or even Huawei, which has been sending equipment. And this is essentially a bilateral game for them in whatever they're doing. In contrast, when you look at India, we've done things bilaterally, but we've taken the big step of initiating multilateral cooperation. So whether it's through SAARC or whether it's through that idea that let's get the G20 together. So it just tells you a little bit about the power dynamics of each state, but also the approach of each state to international relations, right?
Yeah.
It's fascinating how the world is sort of shaping up to be. There's an interesting sort of framework that came up. There's a new piece in Foreign Affairs, and we'll try and link that also, which discusses the what's happening currently in the world. And it talks about essentially in the context of the US and China, and it talks about any sort of leadership in these times will be dependent on three factors. Actions you take within your own territory to contain this virus and the legitimacy of your actions because of the effectiveness. I think effectiveness is one parameter, but there could be others. Provision of public goods internationally and international coordination. Let's try and assess what different countries are doing on these metrics.
Sure.
What's your thought?
I can speak about the United States. I think it actually fails on all three counts. I think that in the US, there's very clear lack of coordination or seriousness about doing lockdowns, procuring enough equipment. Of course, it is true that Americans are known to get off to a slow start whenever a crisis erupts, and then eventually the ball is set rolling, and the whole American juggernaut gets going. America has also failed to do anything significant on the international level. And this has been a running story, perhaps not just through the Trump presidency, but also perhaps going back to Obama. So this is probably something systemic. America has fared a little better in terms of international coordination. You talked about the Indo-Pacific group, and that's probably better than what the Chinese are doing at the moment. Manoj, do you think that's better than what the Chinese are doing at the moment?
I don't know. I mean, my sense is that the Chinese are, just because of capacity, given the fact that, much of the world's drug production is dependent on Chinese APIs, much of the world's mask production is dependent on China. So given the fact that it dominates these manufacturing chains, it gives it a little bit more leverage to do it. And if you look at it, if you just sort of wind back 2 months ago, when China had sort of initiated its process of dealing with this crisis, it sent its factories of these particular items into sort of wartime production mode.
Yeah.
So there's lots of capacity that's built up. So today they have massive capacity that they can, from a point where I remember in January, February, where we were talking about, should India be banning its masks and sort of protective gear sale to China, given that, if you actually send it there, you fight the virus there rather than it coming here.
Yeah.
But today, China sort of mass sort of exporting, selling all this stuff, and a lot of it is the problem with what the Chinese are doing. I mean, if you read their media, what you will see is that there are all these happy faces of, people receiving all this aid, but it's not necessarily aid. Some of this is sales. If there are monies that have been extended, those are loans. So, for example, in the case of Sri Lanka, just last week, there was a grant of sort of $500 million that's been extended. And that's a loan. That's a concessional loan over a period of 10 years. So what they're doing is they're not necessarily providing aid. And that to me in the long term is going to be problematic. In the short term, countries needing materials, supplies, finances will accept whatever is being given. But there are other sort of things, right? I mean, so if you look at the EU, I was reading, if you heard the speech by the Serbian president, where he basically rubbishes the idea of EU unity, essentially saying that, look, there is nothing coming from the EU. And Serbia is not a part of the EU at the moment. But the idea that the European Union cannot sort of take care of its periphery, whereas the Chinese are going to do it. And in that speech, he essentially says, I'm calling out to you, China, can you help us?
Yes.
So I think some of that tells you a little bit about expanding Chinese influence, and the Chinese are going about it with that point of view also. It's not just, you know, we need to tackle this thing. And that's, I think, the most evident, how that's most evident to me is when I just open state media, the lead story right now as we are talking is Xi Jinping calls for building a community of common health for mankind. That's as political as a statement that they could make.
Absolutely.
And I think they're looking at it from that point of view. So Chinese are doing, in terms of the framework, I think Chinese are doing well. They have done fairly well when it comes to their domestic management of the issue, at least if you're going to believe the numbers. And I can doubt the numbers, but the fact that they've shut down hospital capacities that they've built tells you a little bit about the fact that they've probably done a lot of what they're saying makes sense.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you wouldn't shut down capacity.
Clearly, it's under control, or at least under much greater control than it was in the past. It's an amazing turn of tables, right? I mean, from, say, about 45 days back, when China seemed to be in this spiraling crisis, they've really turned it around, and now it's other countries that are in this crisis. But the very fact, Manoj, that China is the country supplying all these things actually draws attention to how skewed global supply chains have become, right? Because companies have been exploiting all this labor and currency arbitrage and have been setting up factories in China. Don't really have those manufacturing capabilities on their own home territory.
Exactly. And that's what tells me that, you know, given that today, you know, when you look at news reports coming out of Britain or the US or other parts of the world, where people are saying, oh, we don't have this capacity. And, you know, in the US, there's this conversation about their national sort of strategic reserve for medical sort of issues, for health issues, the national stockpile of drugs and things like that, and ventilators. It's grossly insufficient to meet this capacity. What it's going to tell you is that going forward, there is a greater likelihood of, you know, the nature of free trade as we've known it to be put under further strain. It's already been in deep strain, but to have sort of further issues in that context, and more countries drawing broader lists of what is relevant for national security and looking at developing more indigenous capacities. I mean, and that's one thing that's going to hit more free trade over a long period of time, because more countries are going to be looking to become more self-reliant, or at least find ways. I mean, if the transatlantic alliance is at a point where, you know, you can't collaborate at all, I don't see what other alliances are going to be formed, like large multilateral alliances, which can actually collaborate. So the more countries will look at indigenous capacity, and that will hit global trade. So that then has other implications for the institutional order, the normative order that we live in.
You can only imagine it will be considerably transformed from what it is today.
Let's look at the scenarios that we have, and let's try and see what we had predicted and where things are at right now, and what we can sort of think of things going forward from here. So Aditya, what is the scenario? So we've done the scenario mapping where we have 20 scenarios. There are many more, but we selected 20 of them to talk about. And in the document, we outlined 20 of them. So Aditya, which of these do you think are we seeing sort of unfolding?
These scenarios were also color-coded. And the only ones that Manoj and I think find convincing are the ones marked in red. And I think the two that seem most relevant to us today are a race to the bottom. So 1929, I think, is quite obvious. What we're experiencing right now is not just like a normal recession. I think somebody maybe in the Atlantic described it as an ice age. Suddenly, everything is frozen, and we don't know what this causes when whole sectors of economies all across the world suddenly stop functioning. What is the result when this crisis blows over? Does everything just come back to normal? Unlikely. People talked about a V-shaped curve, V-shaped recovery. Then they talked about a U-shaped recovery. But we don't really know what sort of recovery we'll see, to what extent that recovery will occur, and how quick it'll be. But in the event of a long-term recession or even depression in the world economy, we're going to see even more populism, even more demands for redistribution, even more backlash against globalization. You're also going to see more attraction for authoritarian forms of government. That's broadly what a 1929 again scenario would look like. But Manoj, what about this race to the bottom?
To me, this is this just seems like, you know, prediction in some way.
Yeah,
but I mean, I'm just going to read out what we've written, and you know, the listeners can make sense of it. This is what it says. We said this is what the scenario would look like. U.S. and China relations would break down, leading to a sidelining of global institutions and the world separating into alliances dominated by either power. Obviously, we're not at this stage right now, but what we're seeing is that the U.S.-China relationship is as strained today as it has been ever since the rapprochement of 1979, or even from Kissinger's time. Today, it's the way the relationship is structured, it's really, really in bad shape. And like you said, Aditya, officials from both sides are making it worse, particularly Mr. Zhao Lijian from Beijing.
Yes.
And in terms of global institutions, I mean, if you just look at the credibility of the World Health Organization at the moment, and how it's essentially been caught in this political rivalry also, tells you a little bit about the impact on global institutions. The next part of this is that the superpowers would compete ruthlessly to expand their blocs while attempting to revive their economies and those of their allies, likely with investment packages or trade barriers as opposed to military intervention. Again, something that's, we're going to wait and see if this, this is something that plays out, but it tells you a little bit about how once the world gets divided and once this sort of divide between the US and China deepens, you're already seeing certain things in this when you see the Indo-Pacific. But this is still iffy, right? Given that a lot of it depends on how Europe will behave once it recovers from all of this and whether the EU actually even survives as a bloc or it alters in some way. Again, it's a really sort of interesting scenario mapping in terms of how it would then affect India, given that there would be a global economic downturn. It would create serious pressure in the country. There would be more demands for social justice. And again, like in 1929, there'd be a greater sort of tendency towards authoritarianism, populism. Very risky, but also the sort of there are pluses to all of this, given that there is a bloc. And if you can, there are two or three different blocs. And if you can sort of play global powers off one another, to ensure that you get the most out of what you can. It can be beneficial from a state point of view, but from a people's point of view, things like high inequality, unemployment, authoritarianism, populism can be extremely troubling. But these are also sort of dire red scenarios that we had, and we hope that increasingly some of this contest that's been playing out sort of eases and more multilateral efforts, something to which, I mean, one would have to sort of credit how the Indian government has done this, where it has actually sought to initiate multilateral efforts, you know, contain its domestic situation. And we'll see what the domestic situation is like in a couple of weeks from now, because this is what the crucial time is. But you know, seek to provide international public goods, where India has sought to fund, you know, provide this build that SAARC fund, its sent supplies to Italy. So there is an effort given our capacities. And lastly, we've also sought to engage multilaterally, not just with SAARC, but also with the G20. And those are the kinds of things that, you know, are good. But again, all of that will depend on how India manages its domestic situation over the next couple of weeks. But yeah, but this doesn't look good. Hopefully things sort of turn out not this bad.
Yeah, well, I will add a note of cautious optimism here. India has in the past dealt with a world order in which you've had two superpowers facing off against each other. And India has had some success in playing them off against each other and maximizing its benefit, though obviously the cost comes from charges of hypocrisy and so on. I think that in the sort of world order that we just talked about, a race to the bottom, India will have to localize a lot more. This includes things like defense manufacture. It'll also have to reduce its dependence on exports for its own economic growth. But I will finally say, Manoj, that you know this crisis is actually really just beginning, though we may hopefully see the worst of it in the next few weeks. Until herd immunity of some sort is reached, until we get a vaccination, hopefully that herd immunity is achieved through a vaccination, this problem isn't going to go away completely. And that is probably a 24-month time frame from now. And in 24 months, all sorts of things can happen.
Yeah, I mean, if in 3 weeks, the world has changed.
Yes. So both good and bad things can happen. So I would definitely recommend that our readers do check out our New World Order scenarios, because you don't know what surprises the world packs in for us don't be surprised entirely if a few years from now there is an economic revival and the world does seem to be a much rosier than it is at this moment.
I'll drink to that. Thank you so much. All right. Thanks so much, Aditya.
Thank you.
We'll try and link up everything in the show notes. So if you'd like to read, please feel free to read and let us know your thoughts on what other scenarios you can probably imagine going forward. And do share them with us too. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.